jumpsuit and raised both his fists in support. His heart leapt when he saw them smile for the first time, and Eli raised a hand of greeting. Buck ran back to the shelter.
"Where have you been, man?" Yakov said. "We thought you got lost or frozen or something."
Buck just sat, wrapping his arms around his knees, hunching his shoulders, and shook his head.
"I'm fine," he said.
GC troops kept crowds several blocks away once the motor coach arrived bearing Nikolai and his entourage. The wind and snow had stopped, but the noonday sun hardly warmed the area. Carpathia remained on the bus as TV personnel set up lights and sound and cameras. Finally, they signaled the potentate and several of his top people, led by Fortunato, disembarked. Carpathia was the last to appear. He approached the fence, behind which the two witnesses still sat. As the world watched on television, Carpathia said,
"I bring you cordial greetings from the global community. I assume, because of your obvious supernatural powers, that you knew I was coming."
Eli and Moshe remained seated. Moshe said,
"God alone is omnipotent, omniscient, and omnipresent. Nonetheless, I am here on behalf of the citizens of the Earth to determine what course we might take to gain respite from this curse on the planet."
The witnesses stood and stepped forward.
"We will speak to you alone."
Carpathia nodded at his minions, and Fortunato, clearly reluctant, led them back to the motor coach.
"All right, then," Carpathia said. "Shall we proceed?"
"We will talk with you alone."
Carpathia looked puzzled, then said,
"These people are merely television technicians, cameramen, and so forth." "We will talk with you alone."
Nikolai cocked his head in resignation and sent the TV crew away as well.
"May we leave the cameras running? Would that be all right?"
"Your quarrel is not with us,"
Eli said.
"Beg pardon? You are not behind the darkness, the resultant global chaos?
Only God is omnipotent.
I am seeking your help as men who claim to speak for God. If this is of God, then I plead with you to help me come to some arrangement, an agreement, a compromise, if you will."
"Your quarrel is not with us."
"Well, all right, I understand that. But if you have access to him,
your quarrel is not with—"
"I appreciate that point. I am asking—"
Suddenly Moshe spoke so loudly that the sound meters had to have maxed out.
"You would dare wag your tongue at the chosen ones of Almighty God?
I apologize, I—"
"You who boasted that we would die before the due time?
Granted, I concede that I—"
"You who deny the one true God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob?"
"In the spirit of ecumenism and tolerance, yes, I do hold that one should not limit his view of deity to one image. But—"
"There is one God and one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus."
"That is a valid view, of course, just like many of the other views."
"It is written, 'Beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit, after the tradition of men, after the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ.'"
"Do you not see that yours is such an exclusivist?"
"Your quarrel is not with us."
"We are back to that again, are we? In the spirit of diplomacy, let me suggest—"
But the two witnesses turned away and sat down again.
"So that is it, then? Before the eyes of the world, you refuse to talk, to negotiate? All I get is that my quarrel is not with you?
With whom, then, is it?"
"All right, fine."
Carpathia marched in front of the main camera and stared into it from inches away. He spoke wearily, but with his usual precise enunciation.
Upon further review, the death of the Global Community Guard at the meeting of the witnesses was not the responsibility of any of the witnesses or any member of Dr. Benjuda's inner circle. The man killed by GC troops at the airport was not a terrorist. My good friend Dr. Chaim Rosenzweig was at no time and in no way holding Benjuda or his people at our behest. As of this moment, no one sympathetic to Dr. Benjuda and his teachings is considered a fugitive or an enemy of the global community. All citizens are equally free to travel and live their lives in a spirit of liberty. I do not know with whom I am or should be negotiating, but I assure whoever it is that I stand willing to make whatever other concessions would move us closer to the end of this plague of darkness. He turned on his heel, sarcastically saluted the two witnesses, and reboarded the motor coach. As the TV crew rushed to gather their equipment, the witnesses spoke in unison from where they sat, clearly loud enough for anyone, even Carpathia, to hear.
Woe, woe, woe unto all who fail to look up and lift up your heads!
2 days later, the sun rose bright and full, and the earth began to thaw. Buck made plans to fly home freely under his own name.
I can't fly directly to Chicago commercially, he told Rayford. Even with the reconstruction of Midway, I have to go through Europe.
Any connections through Athens?
I'll check. Why?
Rayford asked that he check on Lucas Miklos.
I'll see if he can greet you at the airport.
It won't delay your trip home, and it'll really encourage him. In Mount Prospect, Zion told Rayford he was working on what would be his most dramatic and ominous warning yet. Meanwhile, he broadcast worldwide over the internet,
"Because of the proven truth of Luke chapter 21, I urge all, believers and unbelievers alike, to train your eyes on the skies. I believe this is the message from the two witnesses."
Doc Charles dug out and cleaned up Donnie Moore's telescope, and with millions around the world, he began monitoring the heavens. But when Zion announced in one of his daily messages that he was investigating a way to build a website that would allow others to watch the skies through the same telescope, Rayford received a frantic call from David Hasid in New Babylon.
"Glad I caught you," he said breathlessly. "How far along are you with that telescope website idea?"
"Couple of days yet. Won't take our people long."
"You don't want to do that. A little software and a bright astronomer could just about pinpoint where you guys are."
Rayford put a hand atop his head.
"Thanks for that, David. I never would have thought of that.
Anyway, the potentate himself has authorized the purchase of a colossal telescope, and I get to work with the guys who will man it. Several can monitor it at once through various computers."
"Well, David, you know what we're looking for."
"I sure do."
Chapter 16. The following week, news programs reported that stargazers from around the globe were tracking what appeared at first to be a shooting star. But this one, first seen during nighttime hours in Asia, didn't streak across the sky for a second or two and disappear. Neither was this hurtling object in an orbital trajectory. Astronomers were fond of explaining that, due to the speed of light and the distance from the Earth of even the nearest stars, shooting stars were events that actually occurred years before and were just being seen now. But after several hours of every amateur and professional telescope jockey in the world tracking it, it was becoming clear that this was no ordinary star. Neither was this an event that had happened years before.
Experts unable to identify it agreed it was tiny, it was falling straight, and it had been descending a long time. It radiated little heat, but seemed to emit its own light as well as reflecting light from stars and the sun, depending on the time of day. The more closely it was studied, the less a threat it appeared to Earth. The head of GCASA said it had every chance of burning up as it hit Earth's atmosphere. But even if it remains intact, it has a high probability of landing harmlessly in water. From what we are able to speculate about its mass and density, if it was to hit land, it would suffer far more damage than it could inflict. In all likelihood, it would be vaporized. Still, none seemed able to turn their telescopes from it. Eventually, the unidentified falling object was projected to land somewhere in an uninhabited region of the Fertile Crescent, near what many believed was the cradle of civilization. GC scientists reached the projected touchdown point in time to see the impact, but they reported that it appeared to slip past the Earth's surface into a deep crevice. Aerial studies of the area showed the impossibility of vehicular or foot traffic to more closely evaluate the object and its effect or lack thereof on the Earth's crust. As planes circled and shot still pictures and videotape, however, a geological eruption registered high on the Richter scale of seismology sensors all over the world. This thing that fell to Earth, whatever it was, had somehow triggered volcano-like activity deep beneath the Earth's surface. The shock wave alone blew the surveillance planes off course and forced their pilots to fight to stay airborne and escape the area. Astounding scientists, the first evidence of what happened beneath the Earth was a mushroom cloud 1,000 times bigger and launched with that much more power and speed than any in history produced by bombs or natural phenomena. Also unique about this eruption was that it came from the crevice below sea level rather than from the typical volcanic mountain. Cameras 1,000 miles from the source of the cloud picked up images of it within 12 hours. Rather than being carried on indiscriminate winds, this cloud, massive and growing, fed from the belching earth, spread equally in all directions, and threatened to block the sun all over the globe. And this was no smoky cloud that thinned and dissipated as it traveled. The thick fumes that gushed from the ground were dense and black like the base of a gasoline fire. Scientists feared the source of the smoke was a colossal fire that would eventually rise and shoot flames miles into the air. Early the following Monday afternoon in Jerusalem, Buck was devastated to learn that his flight to Athens and then on to the States had been canceled. The billowing cloud of smoke that blanketed the earth had affected daylight again. Buck had looked forward to a 2-hour layover during which he would meet Lucas Miklos. He was then to switch planes and fly non-stop the rest of the way to Chicago's Midway Airport. He was to proceed from there to Mount Prospect only after determining that he wouldn't lead any enemies to the safe house. He and the stateside members of the Tribulation Force had developed options to misdirect tails and shake them free. Instead, Buck hurried to Chaim Rosenzweig's home under the cover of darkness. "Be wary of Carpathia's claim that you are not still a suspect," Chaim said. "Nikolai is not speaking to me. Leon is fuming. While they cannot casually renege on their agreement, they will soon find some justification." "Don't worry. I'm so eager to see Chloe, I may fly under my own power." "Be careful of Enigma Babylon." "What's Peter up to now? You haven't heard?" Buck shook his head. "Too busy getting ready to go." Chaim turned on the TV. "I could quote this by heart. I've heard it so many times today. It's the only thing in the news outside the smoking volcano." Matthews, in full clerical regalia again, spoke to the camera. "The global community may have a tacit agreement with black magic religious terrorists, but the time has come to enforce the law. Enigma Babylon One World Faith is the accepted religion for the whole world. As much as it is in my power, and a careful reading of the Global Community Charter reveals that this clearly falls within my purview, I will prosecute offenders. So that all may be clear, I consider exclusivist, intolerant, one-way-only beliefs antithetical to true religion. If, because of misplaced diplomacy, the Global Community Administration feels it must allow diversions from cosmic truth, Enigma Babylon itself must go on the offensive. To be an atheist or an agnostic is one thing. Even they are welcome beneath our all-inclusive banner. But it is illegal to practice a form of religion that flies in the face of our mission. Such practitioners and their followers will suffer. As a first initiative in a sweeping effort to rid the world of intolerance, it shall be deemed criminal as of midnight Tuesday, Greenwich Mean Time, for anyone to visit the website of the so-called Tribulation Force. The teachings of this cult's guru, Dr. Zion Ben Judah, are poison to people of true faith and love, and we will not tolerate this deadly toxin pushed like a drug. Technology is in place that can monitor the internet activity of any citizen, and those whose records show they have accessed this site after the deadline shall be subject to fine and imprisonment. A Global Community reporter interrupted. Two-part question, Supreme Pontiff. One, how does imprisoning people for what they access on the web jibe with tolerance, faith, and love? And two, if you can monitor everyone's internet activity, why can't you trace where Ben Judah transmits from and shut him down? I'm sorry, one of his aides said as Peter II was ushered away, but we established in advance that we would not have time for questions. I'd like to get a peek at that reporter's forehead, Buck thought. It made him wish his cover hadn't been blown and that he was still working from the inside. It was early morning in the Chicago area as Rayford pulled away from the safe house in Buck's Range Rover. Despite the smoky skies, he felt he had to get to Paul Walkie and check on the condition of Ken Ritz's Suburban. It seemed in better shape than the Rover. The Trib Force could use it, but Rayford didn't know how a dead man's belongings should be disposed of, especially those of a man with no living kin. Rayford suddenly heard a voice, as if someone were in the car with him. The radio was off, and he was alone, but he heard, clear as if from the best sound system available, "Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound." His phone chirped. It was David from New Babylon. "Captain Steele, I'm outside right now, and I don't know what kind of spin we're going to put on this one, but I'll bet my life it'll never make the news." "I heard it. It doesn't have to make the news." "Everybody in here saw it before we heard it." "Well, at least our equipment detected it. We can't see a thing through this cloud of smoke. But because we have huge radio receivers pointed at the sky anyway, it was plain as day here. I asked a Turkish guy what language it was in, and he said his own. Well, I heard it in English, so you know what I think."
"You saw the angel?"
"Okay, we worked all night because somebody's probe detected something. The digital facsimile made it look like some sort of heavenly body, a comet or something. He gets it all tracked in and measured and whatnot, and we all start studying it."
"Well, I'm no astronomer, so I haven't got a clue what I'm looking at. I tell him it looks real small to me and not very thick. They're all congratulating me because it gave the lead guy an idea. He says, all right, let's assume it's closer and smaller, a lot smaller. So he turns the dials and resets the probe, and all of a sudden the computer is spitting out images we can see and understand. It looked transparent and sort of human-like, but not really.
Anyway, we're following this thing, and then the boss says to point all the radio satellite dishes at it and try to track it that way, the way we do the stars in the daylight. Next thing you know, we hear the announcement. Well, it's all staticky and crackly, and we miss the first word, but of course I've been reading Dr. Benjuda's stuff, so I know what it is, because the next two words are the same and clear. I'm telling you, Captain, it freaked out everybody, and I mean everybody. Guys were on the floor, crying. They've been playing the tape over and over in there, and I even copied it on my dictation machine. But you know what? It records only in Greek. Everybody heard it in his own language, but it was Greek.
Buck heard the angel and mistook it for the TV until he saw the look on Chaim's face. The old man was terrified. How could he or anyone doubt the existence of God now? This was no longer about ignorance. It was about choice.
Rayford parked near the hangar where Ken Ritz had lived before moving to the safe house. There, his head under the hood of Ritz's Suburban, was Ernie, the new believer. He looked up and squinted through the haze as Rayford approached. Ernie smiled, shook his hand with enthusiasm, and pushed his greasy hat back on his head. The mark on his forehead stood out clearly, as if he was proud of it, but he was also shivering.
"That was scary, wasn't it?" he said.
"Shouldn't be to those of us who knew it was coming," Rayford said. "You have nothing to fear. Not even death. None of us wants to die, but we know what comes next."
"Yeah," Ernie said, adjusting his hat again. "But still."
"How's Ken's car doing?"
Ernie turned back to the engine.
"Pretty good shape for all it's been through, I'd say."
"You find this therapeutic?"
"I'm sorry," Ernie said. "I was never much of a student. What's that mean?"
"Does it help you remember Ken without it being too painful for you?"
"Oh, well, I didn't really know him that long. I mean, I was shocked and I'll miss him, but I just did stuff for him. He paid me, you know."
"But you both being believers..."
"Yeah, that was good. He put me onto that Benjuda guy's website."
A car pulled up to the rebuilt tower across the way, and two men in shirts and ties got out. One was tall and black, the other stocky and white. The first went into the tower, the other approached Ernie and Rayford. Ernie emerged from under the hood again and pulled his cap low across his brow.
"Hey, Bo," he said. "Do you hear that voice out of the sky?"
"I heard it," Bo said, obviously disgusted. "If you believe it was a voice from the sky, you're loopier than I thought."
"Well, what was it then?"
Ernie said as Bo studied Rayford.
"Those crazy fundamentalists again, playing with our minds. Some sort of loudspeaker trick. Don't fall for it."
Ernie emitted an embarrassed laugh and looked self-consciously at Rayford.
"Howdy," Bo said, nodding to Rayford. "Can I help you with something?"
"No, thanks. Just a friend of Ken Ritz."
"Yeah, that was awful."
"Actually, I just came by to see about his belongings. I don't believe there were any living relatives."
Ernie straightened up and turned around so quickly that even Bo seemed taken aback. It was clear both wanted to say something, but each looked at the other and hesitated. Then they both spoke at once. Bo said,
"And so you just thought you'd come by and see what you could..."
While Ernie was saying,
"No, that's right. No relatives. In fact, he told me just a week or so ago that..."
Ernie conceded the floor first, and the man backed up and finished his thought.
"You'd come by and see what you could make off with, is that it?"
Rayford recoiled at such insensitivity, especially on the part of a stranger.
"That's not it at all, sir. I..."
"Where do you get off calling me sir? You don't know me."
Caught off guard, Rayford's old nature took over.
"What, am I talking to an alien? How does polite society refer to strangers on your planet, Bo?"
He hit the name with as much sarcasm as he could muster. Rayford was much taller, but Bo was built like a linebacker. With his blonde crew cut, he looked the part, too.
Why don't you just take your opportunistic tail out of here while it's still part of your body? Beau said.
Rayford was boiling and repenting of his attitude even as he spewed venom.
Why don't you mind your own business while I talk privately with Ernie?
Beau stepped closer to Rayford and made him wonder if he would have to defend himself.
Because Ernie's on my payroll, Beau said, and everything on this property is my business, including Ritz's effects.
Rayford took a deep breath and regained control of his emotions.
Then I'll be happy to talk to Ernie on his own time, and on his own property, Beau added.
Fine, but what gives you the right to Ken Ritz's stuff?
What gives you any right to it?
I haven't claimed any right to it, Rayford said, but I think its disposition is a valid question. Ernie looked ill.
Beau, sir, Ken told me that if anything ever happened to him, I could have his stuff.
Yeah, right.
He did. The planes, this car, his personal junk, whatever I wanted.
Rayford looked suspiciously at Ernie. He didn't want to question a fellow believer, especially in front of an outsider, but he had to.
I thought you told me you two hardly knew each other.
I'll handle this, Beau said. That's bull, Ernie, and you know it. Ritz was part owner of this airport, and... Rayford cocked his head quickly.
That didn't mesh with what Ken had told Rayford about wanting to buy the place.
Beau must have noticed Rayford's reaction and assumed he knew more than Beau thought.
Well, he adjusted midstream. He made an offer anyway, or was going to. Actually, yeah, an offer was made. So if there are assets in his estate, they would be the property of Paul Waukee ownership.
Rayford felt his blood boil again.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. He dies before your deal is consummated, so you take his estate in exchange for what? You're going to change the name of the place to Ritz Memorial? You take his assets and he gets what? Posthumous ownership while you run it for him and take the profits?
So what's your stake in this, smarty pants?
Rayford nearly laughed. Was he back on the playground in fourth grade? How had he come to a shouting match with a total stranger?
As I said, I made no claim, but my stake now is to be sure nothing happens to my friend's legacy that he didn't intend to happen.
He intended for me to have it, Ernie said. I told you that.
Ernie, Beau said, stick to your grease monkeying and keep your nose out of this, will you? And wipe that smudge off your forehead. You look like a snot-nosed rugrat.
Ernie tugged down on his cap and whirled around to busy himself under the hood again. He was muttering,
I'm taking the stuff he said I could have, I tell you that right now. You're not bullying me into giving up what I know is rightfully mine. No way.
Rayford was disgusted with Ernie's obvious lies, but even more so that he was ashamed of the mark of God. And then it hit him. Only other believers could see the mark. Was Rayford arguing with a fellow tribulation saint? He looked quickly at Beau's forehead, which, because of his haircut and his complexion and the breadth of his face, had been right in front of Rayford's eyes the whole time. Even in the dense smog, Beau's skin was as clear as a baby's. Buck felt restless. He sat across from Chaim Rosenzweig in the parlor of his estate and was nearly overcome with compassion for the man.
Doctor, he said, how can you see and know and experience all we have endured, all of us, even you, these last few years, and yet still resist the call of God on your life?
Don't be offended. You know I care for you, as does Zion and my wife and her father.
You told an international audience on TV that Ben Judah was proven correct in his interpretations of what was to come. Forgive me for being so forward, but the time is growing short.
I confess I have been troubled, Rosenzweig said, especially since Ben Judah stayed with me. You have heard my arguments against God in the past, but no, not even I can deny he is at work today. It is too plain, but I have to say I don't understand your God. He seems mean-spirited to me.
Why can he not get people's attention through wonderful miracles as he did in the Bible? Why make things worse and worse until a person has no choice? I find myself resisting being forced into this by the very one who wants my devotion. I want to come willingly on my own accord, if at all.
Buck stood and pulled back the drape. The skies were growing darker, and he heard a low rumble in the distance. Should he stay away from the window? The weather hadn't portended rain. What was the noise? He could see no more than 10 feet through the heavy smoke.
Doctor, God has blessed you beyond what any human deserves. If your wealth of friends, education, knowledge, creativity, challenge, admiration, income, and comfort do not draw you to him, what else can he do?
He is not willing that any should perish, and so he resorts to judgments that will drive them to him or away from him forever. We're praying you will choose the former.
Rosenzweig appeared older than his age. Weary, drawn, lonely, he looked like he needed rest. But life was hard everywhere. Buck knew everything would head downhill from here. The old man crossed his legs, appeared uncomfortable, and set his feet flat on the floor again. He seemed distracted, and he and Buck had to raise their voices to even hear each other.
I must tell you that your praying for me means more than I can...
He furrowed his brow.
What is that noise?
The rumble had become higher pitched and had developed a metallic sound.
It's like chains clanging together, Buck said. A low-flying craft?
The airports are closed, Doctor.
It's getting louder. And it's darker. It's dark as night out there. Open that drape all the way, Cameron, please. Oh, my heavens!
The sky was black as pitch and the racket deafening. Buck spun to look at Chaim, whose face matched Buck's own terror. Metal against metal clanged until both men covered their ears.
Rattling, thumping against the windows now, the rumble had become a cacophony of piercing, irritating, rattling, jangling that seemed it would invade the very walls.
Buck stared out the window and his heart thundered against his ribs. From out of the smoke came flying creatures.
Hideous, ugly, brown and black and yellow flying monsters. Swarming like locusts, they looked like miniature horses 5 or 6 inches long with tails like those of scorpions. Most horrifying, the creatures were attacking, trying to get in. And they looked past Buck as if Chaim were their target.
The old man stood in the middle of the room.
Cameron, they're after me, he screamed. Tell me I'm dreaming. Tell me it's only a nightmare.
The creatures hovered, beating their wings and driving their heads into the window.
I'm sorry, Doctor, Buck said, shuddering, his arms covered with goose flesh. This is real. It's the first of the 3 woes the angels warned about. What do they want? What will they do?
Zion teaches that they will not harm any foliage like locusts usually do, but only those who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads.
Chaim paled, and Buck worried he might collapse.
Sit down, sir. Let me open the window.
No, keep them out. I can tell they mean to devour me.
Maybe we can trap one or two between the screen and the window and see them more clearly.
I don't want to see them. I want to kill them before they kill me.
Chaim, they have not been given the authority to kill you.
How do you know?
He sounded like a schoolboy now, doubting the doctor who's told him a shot won't hurt bad.
I won't tell you they won't torment you, but the Bible says the victims they attack will want to die and be unable to. Oh, no!
Buck turned a crank that swung open the window. Several creatures flew near the screen, and he quickly shut the window. Now trapped between, they flew crazily, straining, fighting, banging off each other. The harsh metallic sound increased.
Aren't you the least bit curious?
Buck said, fighting to not turn from the sight of them.
They're fascinating hybrids. As a scientist, don't you want to at least see...
I'll be right back, Chaim cried, and he hurried away. He returned looking ridiculous, dressed head to toe in beekeeping garb, boots, bulky canvas body smock, gloves, hat with face mesh and material covering his neck. He carried a cricket bat. Blood-curdling screams rose above the clamor. Chaim rushed to the other window, threw back the drape, and fell to his knees. Oh, God, he prayed, save me from these creatures, and don't let Jonas die. Buck looked over Chaim's shoulder out to the gate. Jonas lay writhing, screaming, thrashing, slapping at his legs and torso, trying to cover his face. He was covered with the locusts. We've got to get him inside, Buck said. I can't go out. They'll attack me. Buck hesitated. He believed he was invulnerable to the creature's stings, but his mind had trouble communicating that to his legs. I'll go, he said. How will you keep the creatures out? I can only do the best I can. Do you have another bat? No, but I have a tennis racket. That'll have to do. Buck headed downstairs with the racket. Chaim called after him. I'm going to lock myself in this room. Be sure you've killed or kept out all of them before coming back in. And put Jonas in the front guest room. Will he die? He'll wish he could, Buck said. He waited at the front door. The smoke that had hung over the city for days was gone, having left just as dense a spread of the ghastly beings. Praying for courage, Buck opened the door and ran to Jonas, who now lay quivering and twitching. Jonas, let's get you inside. But he was unconscious. Buck set the racket down and used both hands to grab the big man by the shoulder and roll him over. His face showed one welt, and he was beginning to swell. A barrel-chested, beefy man, Jonas was going to be difficult to move. Buck tried to remember the fireman's carry, but he couldn't get enough leverage to get Jonas off the ground. The locusts, too tame a description for these revolting beasts, flew menacingly around Buck's head, and some even landed. He was astonished at their weight and thickness. And while he was relieved they didn't sting or bite, he heard their hisses and believed they were trying to drive him away from Jonas. When one hovered over Jonas's face, Buck snatched up the racket and stepped into a full, hard backhand, sending the locust rocketing through a window at the front of the house. The sensation of beast on strings felt as if he had smacked a toy metal car. His first order of business, if he ever got back into the house, was to board up that window and get rid of that animal. Buck tucked the racket under his arm and resorted to pulling Jonas by his wrists, on his back, up to the house. About 10 feet from the stairs, their progress stopped, and Buck discovered Jonas's waistband and belt had torn up grass as he slid. Buck spun him around and tucked the man's ankles under his own arms and kept going. When he reached the steps, he sucked it up, bent at the knees, and lifted Jonas up onto his shoulders. He believed the man outweighed him by 100 pounds. In the house, he plopped Jonas into a chair, from which he nearly toppled before rousing enough to at least keep his balance. Another locust flew in before Buck could shut the door, and he smacked it with the racket as well. It skittered across the floor and rebounded off the wall, rattling as it rolled. It lay stunned, its segmented abdomen heaving. Buck's first target chose that moment to attack, and Buck knocked it out of the air again. He tried stepping on one and found its shell unbreakable. He nudged both onto the face of the racket with his foot and shoveled them out the door, slamming it shut before more could invade. He covered the broken window and helped the staggering Jonas to the front guest room. There Jonas stretched out on the bed, incoherent and groaning and tearing at the buttons on his shirt. Knowing there was no remedy for the torture and agony the man would endure, Buck reluctantly left him and returned to the parlor upstairs. Like a person perversely drawn to a train wreck, Buck wanted a close look at these things with a glass barrier between him and them. Before unlocking the door, Chaim demanded that Buck double and triple check that he wasn't accidentally bringing a locust in with him. Buck found Chaim still shrouded in the beekeeper getup and wielding the cricket bat. After demanding to know Jonas was still alive, Chaim grabbed Buck's arm and dragged him to the window.
Angry locusts, trapped between glass and screen, were front and center, ready for study. Buck knew that any unbeliever on the street had already suffered Jonas's fate, and that it couldn't be long before the locusts would begin finding their way into homes and apartments. This was going to be the worst horror yet.
Chapter 17. Rayford grabbed Ernie by the collar and pulled him close, feeling the rage of a parent against a threat to his family.
"So you're an imposter, hey, Ernie?"
Rather than fighting, Ernie tried to hold his hat on with both hands. Rayford let go of his collar and drove his hand directly under the bill of the cap. Ernie flinched, obviously thinking he was about to take an uppercut to the nose, and released his grip just enough so Rayford sent his cap flying. No wonder Ernie's mark had appeared so prominent. He had refreshed it with whatever he had used to create it in the first place.
"You'd fake the mark, Ernie? The mark of the sealed of the Lord? That takes guts."
Ernie paled and tried to pull away, but Rayford grabbed the back of his neck and, with his free hand, pressed his thumb against Ernie's bogus mark. The smudge rubbed off.
"You must have studied Zion's teaching really well to replicate a mark you've never seen."
"What the heck is that?"
Bo asked, seeming frozen to his spot.
"He faked the mark of..."
"I know all about that,"
Bo said, his eyes wide with fear. He pointed past Rayford.
"I mean that."
Rayford looked into the distance where the cloud of smoke was turning into a swarming wave of locusts. Even from a few hundred yards, they looked huge, and what a racket.
"I hate to tell you this, gentlemen, but you're in big trouble."
"Why?"
Bo cried.
"What is it?"
"One of your last warnings, or another trick by the fundamentalists. You decide."
"Do what you want, Bo," Ernie said. "I'm getting out of here."
He lit out for the tower, which apparently appealed to Bo, too. When Ernie had trouble opening the door, Bo skidded into him, plastering him against it. They both went down, Ernie holding his knee and whimpering.
"Get up and get in there, you sissy," Bo said.
"Yeah, well, so are you, you big sissy boy, Bo."
Bo yanked the door open, and it banged Ernie's head. He swore and spun on his seat and kicked it shut as Bo was trying to get in. Bo dropped to one knee, sucking his slammed fingernail, and Ernie jumped up and stepped over him into the safety of the tower. Rayford arrived at the door and tried to help Bo up, but Bo wrenched away. The locusts swarmed Bo. He kicked and screamed and ran in circles, and when Ernie opened the door to taunt him and laugh at him, he too was attacked. The black man who had been in the car with Bo appeared in the doorway, staring in horror at the suffering man and boy. He shook his head slowly and looked up at Rayford. They noticed each other's marks immediately, and Rayford knew his was genuine because the locusts left him alone. Rayford helped him fight off the locusts and haul the two onto a landing at the bottom of the stairs. As Bo and Ernie shook and swelled and fought for breath, Rayford accepted the man's handshake.
"T.M. Delante," he said. "I go by T."
"Rafe, I know who you are, Captain. Ken told me all about you."
"Sorry to sound rude," Rayford said, "but it's odd he never mentioned you."
Odder still, Rayford thought, was their getting acquainted with two suffering victims at their feet.
"I asked him not to. It's great to know he was what I thought he was, a man of his word."
Rayford wanted to talk with T, but he felt obligated to do something for Bo and Ernie. "Any place we can put these guys?" T nodded to a reception area with couches and chairs, but otherwise empty.
"I understand they're not gonna die, but they're gonna wish they could."
Rayford nodded.
"You study, do you?" "I'm in Zion's cyber class, like pretty much every other believer in the world."
"I'd better check on Zion and the others," Rayford said, pulling out his phone. Chloe answered.
"Oh, Dad, it's horrible. Hattie's already been attacked."
Rayford heard her screaming in the background.
"Can Doc help?"
"He's trying, but she's cursing God and already wants to die.
Zion says this is just the beginning. He believes she'll be in torment for 5 months. By then, we're going to want to put her out of her misery ourselves.
We can pray she'll become a believer before that.
Yeah, but Zion doesn't think that guarantees instant relief.
That sounded strange to Rayford. He would have to ask Zion about that later. Everybody else all right?
Think so. I'm waiting to hear from Buck.
Buck was surprised to learn he had more capacity for revulsion. As he and Chaim knelt by the window, their faces inches from the locusts, he saw scripture come to life. He couldn't imagine an uglier, more nauseating sight than the creatures before him. Zion taught that these were not part of the animal kingdom at all, but demons taking the form of organisms. As he took in their unique characteristics, he felt for Chaim. They both knew his protective covering would not save him in the end. These things were here to attack him, and time was on their side. They would find a way in, and when that happened, they would show no mercy.
"Good heavens, look at them," Chaim said.
Buck could only shake his head. Contrasted with the beauty of God's creation, these mongrels were clearly from the pit. Their bodies were shaped like miniature horses armed for war. They had wings like flying grasshoppers. When one alighted on the window, Buck edged closer.
"Chaim," Buck said, his own voice sounding distant and fearful. "Do you have a magnifying glass? You want a closer look? I can hardly stand to peek at them."
"They look like horses, but they don't have snouts and mouths like horses.
I have a very powerful magnifier in my office, but I'm not leaving this room."
Buck ran off and got it from the study near Chaim's bedroom. But as he dashed back, he heard a dreadful, inhuman howl and the bumps and bangs of someone thrashing on the floor. The someone, of course, was Chaim Rosenzweig, and the howl was human after all. One of the locusts had found a way in and had locked itself onto Chaim's wrist, between his glove and sleeve. The old man lay jerking as if in the throes of a seizure, wailing and crying as he slammed his hand on the ground, trying to dislodge the brute.
"Get it off me!" he bellowed. "Please, Cameron, please! I'm dying!"
Buck grabbed the thing, but it seemed stuck as if by suction. It felt like an amalgam of metal, spiny protrusions, and insect slime. He dug his fingers between its abdomen and Chaim's wrist and yanked. The locust popped free, twisted in his hand, and tried stinging him from one end and biting him from the other. Though it had no effect on him, Buck instinctively threw it against the wall so hard it dented the plaster and rattled noisily to the floor.
"Is it dead?" Chaim cried. "Tell me it's dead."
"I don't know that we can kill them," Buck said, "but I stunned a couple of other ones, and this one is immobile right now."
"Smash it," Chaim insisted. "Stomp on it. Smack it with the bat."
He rolled to his side in convulsions. Buck wanted to help him, but Zion had been clear that he found in the scriptures no mention of relief to the victims of a sting. The magnifying glass lay on the floor a few feet from the unmoving locust. Keeping an eye on the creature, Buck held the glass over it, illuminated by the chandelier directly above. He nearly vomited at the magnified ugliness. It lay on its side, appearing to regroup. The four horse-like legs supported a horse-shaped body consisting of a two-part abdomen. First was a pre-abdomen in the torso area made up of 7 segments and draped by a metallic breastplate that accounted for the noise when it flew. The posterior consisted of 5 segments and led to the scorpion-like stinger tail, nearly transparent. Buck could see the sloshing venom. Its eyes were open and seemed to glare at Buck. In a strange way, that made sense. If Zion was right and these were demons, they were madly conflicted beings. They would want to kill believers, but they were under instructions from God to torment only unbelievers. What Satan meant for evil, God was using for good. Buck held his breath as he moved the glass in his own face closer to the locust. He had never seen a head like that on any living thing. The face looked like that of a man, but as it writhed and grimaced and scowled at Buck, it displayed a set of teeth way out of proportion. They were the teeth of a lion with long canines, the upper pair extending over the lower lip. Most incongruous, the locust had long, flowing hair like a woman's, spilling out from under what appeared to be a combination helmet and crown, gold in color. Though no larger than a man's hand, the grossly overgrown combination insect, arthropod, and mammal appeared invincible. Buck was encouraged to know he could temporarily shock them with a hard blow, but he had neither killed nor apparently even injured any. He had no idea how to toss the thing out of the house without letting in dozens more. Buck scanned the room and noticed a heavy vase holding a large plant. Chaim was already incoherent, crawling to the door.
"Bed!" he said. "Water!"
Buck pulled the plant from the vase and laid it on the floor, muddy roots and all. He turned the vase over and set it atop the locust, which had just begun to move about again. Within a minute, he heard the metallic whirring as it banged again and again against the inverted vase. It tried to escape through a small hole in what had become the top of its makeshift prison, but it could only poke its head through. Buck staggered and nearly fell when it seemed to shout, as if crying for help. Over and over it repeated a phrase Buck couldn't understand.
"Do you hear that, Dr. Rosenzweig?" Buck asked.
Chaim lay by the door, panting.
"I hear it," he rasped, groaning. "But I don't want to. Burn it, drown it, do something. But help me to bed and get me some water."
The creature called out in a mournful keen what sounded to Buck like, "A bad one, a bad one."
"These things speak," Buck told Chaim, "and I think it's English."
Rosenzweig shook as if the temperature had dropped below freezing.
"Hebrew," he said. "It's calling out for Abaddon."
"Of course," Buck said. "Zion told us about that. The king over these creatures is the chief demon of the bottomless pit, ruler over the fallen hordes of the abyss. In the Greek, he has the name Apollyon."
"Why do I care to know the name of the monster that killed me?" Rosenzweig said.
He reached up for the doorknob, but couldn't unlock the door with his gloves on. He shook them off, but could no longer raise an arm. Buck got him up, and as they lumbered out of the parlor, he looked back at the locust trying to squeeze out of the vase. It looked at him with such hatred and contempt that Buck nearly froze.
"Abaddon!" it called out,
and the tiny but gravelly voice echoed in the hallway. Buck kicked the parlor door shut and helped Chaim into his bedroom. There, Buck peeled the rest of the beekeeper garb off Chaim and helped him lie back atop the covers on his bed. Convulsions racked him again, and Buck noticed swelling in his hands and neck and face.
"Could you get me some water, please?"
"It won't help," Buck said, but he got it anyway. Parched himself, he poured into a glass some of the bottle he found in the refrigerator and quenched his own thirst. He grabbed a clean glass and returned. He set the bottle and the glass on a stand next to the bed. Chaim appeared unconscious. He had rolled on his side, covering his ears with a pillow as the haunting cries continued from the parlor.
"Abaddon! Abaddon! Abaddon!"
Buck laid a hand on the old man's shoulder.
"Can you hear me, Chaim? Chaim!"
Rosenzweig pulled the pillow away from his ear.
"Huh? What?"
"Don't drink the water. It's turned to blood."
Rayford and T.M. Delante stood outside the empty reception area at the base of the Pulwalkie Airport Tower, peering in at Beau and Ernie, who cursed each other as they writhed on the floor.
"Is there nothing we can do for them?" T. asked.
Rayford shook his head.
"I feel sorry for them and for anybody who has to endure this. If they had only listened. The message has been out there since before the rapture. What's their story, anyway?
Ernie had me convinced he was a believer, had the mark and everything.
I was shocked to see him attacked, T said. But part of that had to have been my fault. For days he sounded interested, said Ken was urging him to log on and check out what Zion Ben-Judah was teaching. He asked so many questions, especially about the mark, that between what he learned from Zion and what Ken and I said about it, he was able to fake it.
Rayford looked out. The sky was still filled with the locusts, but all but a few had moved away from the door.
I never thought about anyone being able to counterfeit the mark. I figured the mark, distinguishable only by another believer, was a foolproof test of who was with us and who wasn't. What do we do now? Try the smudge test on anybody who's bearing the mark?
Nope, T said. Don't have to.
Why's that? You're not testing my mark, are you? Why do you assume I'm legit?
Because you weren't attacked.
Bingo. For the next 10 months, that's our litmus test.
Where are you getting 10 months?
You haven't read Dr. Ben-Judah today?
Rayford shook his head.
He says the locusts have 5 months to find their prey and sting them, and that the victims suffer for 5 months. He also believes, though he admitted it was just conjecture, that the locusts bite a person once, and then they move on.
Have you taken a look at these things? Rayford said, studying one on the other side of the window.
Do I want to? T said, approaching. I didn't even like reading about them in Dr. Ben-Judah's lessons. Oh, boy, look at that. That is one ugly monstrosity.
Be glad they're on our side.
Talk about irony, T said. Ben-Judah says they're demons. Yeah, but they're moonlighting for God for a while.
Both men cocked their heads.
What's that sound? Rayford said. Zion said their flight would sound like horses and chariots riding into battle, but I hear something else.
Are they chanting? T said. They cracked the door an inch or so, and a locust tried to squeeze through.
Rayford shut the door on it, and it squirmed and flailed. He released the pressure, and it flew back out.
That's it, Rayford said. They're chanting something. The men stood still. The cloud of locusts on its